from WKAR Studios at Michigan State University. Welcome back to the second half hour of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, catching you up on what's happening around the Capital Region and the Great Lakes. Historically, the environmental movement has not always been welcoming to people of color and the issues that are important to them. But to change the problem, you first have to recognize it. Today, Elizabeth Miller of our reporting partners, Great Lakes Today, tells us about a Michigan event that shook up the entire environmental movement.
You don't have to look very far for events redefining the environmental movement in terms of who works for advocacy groups and who they work for. Just go back to 2014. In April of that year, the city of Flint, Michigan, switched its source of drinking water from the Detroit River to the Flint River. Soon, residents were complaining about the water, saying it was discolored and smelled, and the media seized on the crisis.
Families in Flint file a federal lawsuit over the city's water crisis. They claim the water made them sick.
As the crisis unfolded, thousands of residents were exposed to chemicals, and children tested positive for lead poisoning, a condition that can cause developmental delays and seizures. But it took months for mainstream environmental groups to confront the issues in Flint. They were involved in projects like cleaning up beaches and keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. They didn't pay much attention to drinking water. Jemana Vasi, who funded Great Lakes environmental work at the Flint-headquartered Mott Foundation, explains.
The Mott Foundation, when I was there, primarily funded mainstream environmental organizations, and they worked on sort of traditional environmental issues, water, land, air, focusing on the environmental laws like the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act.
Vasi, who left her job at Mott in June, sees Flint as a turning point for these mainstream groups.
Drinking water infrastructure was very invisible for a very long time until the Flint drinking water crisis happened. But that is Great Lakes water flowing through the city of Flint, flowing through the city of Detroit or Milwaukee or all of Cleveland.
And as Flint pushed groups to look outward and evaluate the issues they supported, another moment in 2014 forced them to look inward. Just a couple of months after the Flint water switch, a group called Green 2.0 released a report detailing the staff diversity of environmental organizations. The news was bad. The University of Michigan's Dr. Dorsita Taylor surveyed nearly 300 organizations and found that people of color made up about 16% of staffers. That's less than half of the nationwide percentage of people of color. And the percentages were even worse for executives and board members. To Joel Bremeyer, president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes.
It was a real, I think, wake-up call to many folks in the environmental community that there's a real gap here.
Bremeyer's organization has since started an equity analysis, hiring a consultant to ensure they're serving everyone in the Great Lakes region. For other environmental organizations, the National Wildlife Federation's Simone Lightfoot says funders can provide that push.
What I've seen most effective, most immediately, is when funders demand a change. When a funder says, you are not getting your check this time until I see diversity among your staff, you'd be amazed at how many people get hired overnight. Overnight.
Back in Flint, there's been a lot of legal fallout. 15 people face criminal charges for their roles in the water crisis.
Running.
Jeffrey Grayer and his company W.T. Stevens are one of several companies replacing 18,000 lead and galvanized steel pipes across the city. On this day, his crew is stationed in front of a house on a Flint street. A big piece of machinery sits in the front yard as workers dig under the street to replace pipes for two homes. But the pipes aren't the only thing on Grayer's mind when it comes to Flint's future.
My hope in terms of the future is a drastic change, turnaround. And, you know, the pipes and the water crisis is one thing. The poverty-stricken area and the lack of education is entirely another discussion and conversation.
But there's still a question of whether the environmental movement is comfortable with that conversation and ready to change its focus. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
An alert. Some content in our next 7-minute segment may not be appropriate for younger listeners. Some places hit hard by the opioid epidemic are also seeing an increase in sexually transmitted diseases. The New York Times recently reported on the rise of syphilis in Oklahoma City, where officials say the trading of sex for drugs has caused a spike in syphilis cases. Syphilis can be deadly, and because many doctors have never seen the disease, it's often misdiagnosed. Infectious disease specialist Dr. Peter Gulick of the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine tells WKER's Scott Pohl that the symptoms of syphilis are different from those of other STDs.
It can present with small ulcers or little lesions on your genitals, and many times they can just be very brief, and they can go away, and you don't even realize you've been exposed to anything. Gonorrhea, chlamydia usually present more with a discharge from your genitals, and so sometimes that can persist a little bit longer and be a little bit irritating. So many times patients that get exposed to syphilis are exposed, but they don't even realize they've been infected with it. And the scary thing about syphilis is it goes through different stages. So it goes through the initial stage where, you know, usually you have some type of a lesion on your genitals. Then it goes away, and then it can activate again and get into your bloodstream and then cause a nonspecific rash. And the problem is many of the healthcare providers aren't used to seeing syphilis. So when they see these rashes, they assume they're either drug-related, allergic reactions, and they don't really know that it's a presentation of syphilis. And I can't tell you how many cases I've seen where a patient will come to me and describe the rash and say that, well, they were told it was secondary to a virus or perhaps just a drug rash or something. And I'll do the test for syphilis, and lo and behold, it's positive. So there's some, you know, cases that present that way. And then the next stage of syphilis is it can actually go into the brain. It can go into other organs, and it can be very devastating there, and it can lead toward long-term side effects of dementia. It can lead toward conditions where the spinal cord can be affected. It can lead to cardiovascular disease with aneurysms. Now, again, we don't see some of those now, fortunately, but we still see a lot of the more advanced cases, and that's just because they aren't being picked up early.
What are the typical methods of treatment?
The treatments are basically the same. They've not changed over the many decades that syphilis has been around. It's basically penicillin. That's really the drug of choice. And depending upon what stage of syphilis, be it early stage or late stage, you might get one shot, you might get a couple shots of penicillin. Now, one interesting thing was we recently had a shortage of penicillin, so we had to rely on other antibiotics, such as tetracycline, for instance, which has been a very effective way of treating it as well. Fortunately, unlike gonorrhea, where we're really dealing now with some strains of gonorrhea that have developed resistance to many of the antibiotics we've used, and it's becoming a very scary organism to treat because of the resistance, syphilis is still very effectively treated as long as you diagnose it.
Would you say it's frequently misdiagnosed then? Is that part of your message?
I would say that it is, yes. Many times when it presents, especially with the skin rash, I've seen that it is missed because most healthcare providers, again, they haven't really seen it, and they're used to seeing the classic presentations of the ulcers on the genitals where you read about it in textbooks. And really, in reality, many times it doesn't present that way.
How do you confirm a diagnosis of syphilis?
Well, there's some blood test you would do. And there's the way they do it now is they do a test that basically tells you, have you been exposed to syphilis or not at any time? So you might have been exposed to it years ago or just recently. If that test is positive, then they do a second test called the RPR, which tells you if it's active at the current time. And it'll give you a number, like a titer, that tells you you have active disease. Because what happens many times is once the patient gets exposed to syphilis, they'll always have this one test that says, yes, you've been exposed, but it doesn't necessarily say it's an active condition.
Do you think the local area in the state of Michigan health departments are set up to detect such an outbreak, maybe in early stages, and limit its size?
We're trying to do more education to the healthcare community about sexually transmitted infections and how these are not just simple infections that, you know, just occur and they're not really something to worry about. But especially with the opioid epidemic, you know, you see other things occurring with that. And one of those is sexually transmitted infections. And syphilis is one of them that many times you don't really think about. And not that it's necessarily transmitted by blood, but it can be transmitted, like I said, through unsafe practices, which many times occur when you're taking different types of opioids, be it oral or IV.
I understand there's something that the medical community calls PrEP. Can you tell me about that
again, I've been a treater of HIV for many years, and we've made so much success in controlling the disease, and where patients have passed away in 2 years after the diagnosis in the 80s, now they're living normal lives, but we're still seeing a constant amount of new cases in the United States, about 50,000. And so what we're trying to do is trying to prevent new cases, and one of those is through a new type of treatment called pre-exposure prophylaxis, called PrEP. And what PrEP has really effectively done is you give this to the patient, not that's positive, that's negative, and it's actually an HIV drug, and it prevents them from getting HIV if they're exposed. So we've been very effective in preventing new cases, but what I have found is that the cases of sexually transmitted infections is increasing in this group, so they're still having unsafe sex. So I've seen more cases of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, and that's why we test these individuals every 3 months, and we test them for STDs, and it's amazing. And many of these STDs in these patients are asymptomatic. The patient didn't even know they were exposed. So we're picking them up early, but the real scary thing is these patients are getting exposed to these STDs. And again, PrEP is used not only for unsafe sex, but it's also used for individuals that have a high risk of using intravenous drugs.
Dr. Peter Gulick is a professor of medicine in the MSU College of Osteopathic Medicine. Thank you.
Thank you.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. It's been a minute. This song, we're definitely going to talk about it. But first, as Aunt Betty said, we have two of the best and brightest stars in Montana. Thank you both for being here. Listeners, you are hearing Montana music from
Coming
Merle
soon to WKAR Weekends is a show from NPR called It's Been a Minute. Host Sam Sanders talks with guests about everything from politics to pop culture. And if you think there's too much bad news in the world, you get to hear some good news that's happening, and there's a way you can share the good news as well. I talked with Sam recently and asked him, where did the name It's Been a Minute come from?
It's funny. The name was the hardest part of the show. We spent months trying to figure it out. We set upon the format of the show pretty quickly. I loved to talk about everything with my friends, and I loved to be able to have wide-ranging conversations, so the format wasn't that hard. The name was, and we ended up with this name for the show. Brent Bachman, who produces the show, he and I were at a mutual friend's wedding, and at the reception, we were talking to a listener. She happened to be the sister of the groom. We told her about our problems with the name and not being able to find one, and over a glass of champagne, she said, how about you call it It's Been a Minute? And we said, huh, yeah. That's it. So it was very spontaneous at a California wedding a few months ago.
What will you be talking about, and what makes your show a little bit different from the other political shows out there?
Yeah, well, we'll be talking about more than politics, for one. The show's kind of about everything. We have been playing with two formats, and you'll hear both of them in the show that you guys pick up. A large part of the show is a conversation between me and two other journalists about the week that was. And we talk about news headlines and topics, big and small, light and heavy. We also talk to listeners and have our listeners call in and tell us about their weeks as well. So that gives you a good kind of feel of the entire week. And the second part of the show will be me in conversation with newsmakers, artists, authors, filmmakers, all kinds of folks. And that together will give you an hour that feels really, really conversational, really of the moment, but entirely loose, kind of in the way that you would be talking with your friends at happy hour on Friday evening.
So the big topic this week is the NFL protest and President Trump's reaction to them. You know, how will you handle that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to talk about it for sure. And the great thing about the show is that we have a few ways to get at it. Usually every week we have a segment called Long Distance, where we talk to a listener out in the world about a bit of news that's affected them. So we've used that segment before to talk to people that have been are recently affected by storms like Hurricane Harvey. We've used that segment just last week to talk with a listener that was involved in some protests in St. Louis. So I could easily see us talking to someone that has felt the effects of these NFL protests firsthand. We also are able to bring in a journalist to the show with all kinds of different expertise. So we might have a sports reporter come on and say, here's what this means in historical context. And I spend a lot of time each week kind of doing my homework to make sure that I'm read in on all the big topics of the week so I can talk about them as well. So there's a few ways to get at it.
So you've talked about everything from migrant workers and, of course, movie reviews. Anything you're keeping your eye on here in Michigan?
I am really interested, particularly in the aftermath of the 2016 election, how both major parties reach out to voters. You know, there was so much attention paid to middle America, to the working class, to white working class voters, and questions raised about who talked to them the right way and appealed to them in the best way after the results of last November. And I'm really interested to see how both parties may or may not tweak their messaging there. You know, I got to travel around a lot covering the campaign, and I heard a bunch of stump speeches. And one of the things that I pretty much know for sure is that the stump speeches we see next go around, they'll be different. And they'll be very different in places like Michigan that are so pivotal to either party's success. So I'll be watching that. I'm also interested to see a lot of the old players that we thought might have gone away at 2016 still being in the mix. You know, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and others are already being shortlisted to be players in 2020. And it's just, I find it fascinating. And I think that a lot of the work that they have to do, should they choose to do it, will be done in states like Michigan. So I'll be watching.
So you've studied in San Antonio and graduated from Harvard Kennedy School. You've been in North Carolina, Oregon, Boston, all over the country. How has that experience helped shape what you're putting into this show?
I think that it's helped me try to, wherever I am, look for those commonalities that can connect us in conversation. I'm not going to pretend that, you know, everyone's all the same and we all can just get along if we hold hands. But I do know that there is a way to talk to people that can be kind of universal. And I've been really lucky to be able to live in different places all across the country and just really work on learning how to talk to people and how to try to forge connections with people from all over the place and all political stripes. And that's really a thing that we want to be present in the show. It's not about agreement. It's not about always having consensus, but it's about always trying to have a conversation and to be open and affirming to all different kinds of folks. And we're trying very hard to do that every day. And I've been lucky enough to have some experience all over the place that helps do that.
And one of my favorite parts is the favorite moments of the week.
Each week, we ask listeners to send us a recording of themselves sharing the best thing that happened to them all week.
The best thing that happened to me this week is that my partner celebrated his birthday and 6 months of sobriety in his addiction recovery.
That's awesome.
I was able to rescue a little hummingbird that had injured its wing.
What? Oh my God.
I was able to take my mom skydiving to celebrate her 50th birthday.
Wow.
I finished all of the work to earn my master's in teaching ESL.
Congrats.
How did that come about, and what are some of the favorite things you've heard listeners share?
Yeah, so we have been just gobsmacked by how successful the segment has been and how positive of a force it's been in listeners' lives and in my life and in Brent's life. I'll give you the full story. You probably got to cut it down in post-prod. But I started asking my friends on Facebook to share the best things of their week years ago, and I've been doing it every Friday for years, and I cannot take credit for the idea. Two friends of mine on Facebook, I won't give their full names, but Daniel and Mel, I saw them both doing it simultaneously. I tracked down that Daniel did it first, and Dan told me that he was accompanying a friend to an alumni happy hour for the friend's old college, but Daniel hadn't gone to the college. So he was like, what am I going to do in all these conversations at this alumni happy hour to make sure that they don't figure out that I don't belong here and kick me out? And he said, the one question I'm sure that I can ask that will always get folks to talk is, what's the best thing that happened to you all week? So it started there at this alumni happy hour. He put it on Facebook. Then Mel put it on Facebook, and I saw it and put it on Facebook. And in the planning for the show, a mutual friend of mine said, hey, I wonder if that Facebook thing you do every Friday, would that work on the radio? And I said, I don't know, but we'll try it. And we did, and it's obviously been a hit. And I think why it works is, I guess for a few reasons. One, particularly in the social media space where a lot of us get our news these days, the default is sarcastic, biting, mean, quick, not nice, right? And two, there is this feeling sometimes that when you're lost in the big news of the week, you lose focus on the small wins and the small good things that happen to you on a daily basis. And I think the best things segment gets at both of those things. It is just moments of unbridled goodwill. You know, there's no snark there. It's really, really earnest, which is nice and refreshing. And it takes things down to the micro level and the personal level, which I just think is needed when you're immersed in big, crazy news stories all week. I gotta say, some of the ones that I enjoy the most are the ones with children and animals. But there was also a really touching one from a listener. He had been colorblind his entire life, and he went to the Grand Canyon with some special glasses that allowed him to see color for the first time. And the first time he saw color was at the Grand Canyon. And he records his own voice there in that moment. And you hear him start to well up, and then I'm in the booth and I start to cry, and it just makes you grateful all over again for so much of the great things that we have in our life every day. And even think about it now, I'm like, let me stop before I, you know, get a little choky. But things like that, it's just great. You know, it's just great to be able to remind ourselves that we can be happy and we can have joy and life can be good regardless of the headlines.
Well, thank you for joining us. Sam Sanders is host of It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders at NPR.
Hey, thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Catch It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders, Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. on the new WKAR News Talk on AM 870 and now around the clock on 94.5 FM and streaming at WKAR.org. Wine and Spirits magazine named six of the country's best sommeliers in their October issue, and one of them is right in our backyard. WKER's Katie Cook had the tough assignment of introducing us.
This is Olin Bauda, Green Yolino.
Justin King is a certified sommelier and co-owner of Bridge Street Social, a 58-seat wine and cocktails-focused restaurant in DeWitt.
Sniffing it here and smelling it, tasting it, there's a lot of a lot of cherry and sort of mushroom, cranberry flavors and aromas.
His restaurant had only been open less than 2 years when he got the call that Wine and Spirits magazine wanted to feature him as one of the country's six best new sommeliers in their October issue.
I'm like, okay, awesome. Like, cool. I was just dumbfounded. I didn't know what to say. I mean, I probably said thank you like 38 times. But that's the thing, man. Like, we are so used to the coasts getting all of this notoriety, but when you grow up in Michigan and you live in Michigan and you own a restaurant in a town of 4,000 people in a tertiary market, you don't really expect these things. I didn't expect this at all.
If you didn't know, a sommelier is essentially a wine steward, a server of wine. But there is a rigorous process of study and examination to receive the designation.
So there are four different levels. There's introductory, there's certified, there's advanced, and then there's master. I want to say there's about 250 master sommeliers in the world. There are three in Michigan or four, depending on the season.
Justin is at the certified level and studying to take the advanced test, which includes performing a mock table service, six blind tastings, and a written theory exam over the course of 3 days.
Something that I think about regarding that process of being a sommelier is not the destination, but what you go through while you do it. It provides access to learning and constantly challenging yourself. And that's the reward there. It's not the certification.
The sommeliers featured in Wine and Spirits were nominated by their peers in the industry. The other five in the October issue were from New York, California, and Texas.
Wine hasn't really found a narrative in Michigan exactly. There is something to be said about a lot of the great wineries up north, also on the lake shore. There's some really impeccable places there. They're doing good things.
Justin thinks one of the things he can focus on at Bridge Street is making wine approachable and accessible to everyone.
It seems as though, knowing what this industry's been like the last 30 years, there were a lot of people, and I think there still are some, that probably took wine too seriously to a point of elitism that showed their superiority in a class sort of way. The point is to democratize wine to an extent.
He's proud to represent Michigan and hopes that what they're doing at Bridge Street can play a small role in bringing more attention to the state.
It's my duty to provide the tools and the resources to my staff and to people who love wine, because if you do that, then as a whole, maybe Michigan gets on the map as a go-to place for wine.
He's passionate about wine, but it's what wine can do for people that Justin gets most excited about.
We can provide a space where people get to know what wine can be, the exciting different styles of wine, and how it unlocks stories and passions and hopes and dreams about vacations or places you've already been or places you want to go, memories of the lands that your family is from, where your ancestors are from. These are things that we try and unlock, and the best way to unlock those things is to do it because you believe in it.
For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
How about some great Michigan folk music to go along with your wine selection? Well, this weekend, an exciting new program joins the lineup. Starting Sunday night at 6, Matt Watroba and WKAR will bring locally hosted folk, blues, and bluegrass music to Capital Region listeners. And guess what? We have a sneak listen of the program right now.
We are all so lucky to live in a state rich in great local music and performers. Towards the end of this hour, I'll tell you about where you can hear some live music in the coming week. Right now, let's sing about Michigan. Here's Mustard's Retreat. Music from the multi-talented Joel Mabus from his album Rhyme Scheme. That was Sugarbush Square Dance. We'll hear a song from Joel in the second hour of the program. Before that, it was the Raisin Pickers, Mark and Carol Palms, along with David Mosier, the title track from the album called Michigan Wind. Kitty Donahoe, before that, she gave us Great Lakes Light from her album Bunyan and Banjos. And it was Ann Arbor's own Mustard's Retreat singing about something, well, many of us would probably like to forget, the Michigan Mosquitoes. Their CD is called A Resolution of Something. You're listening to Folk with Matt Watroba. I mentioned bluegrass a little bit earlier. Let's hear some.
If my feet could walk down that older road, I would follow.
And another reminder, beginning Sunday night at 6 p.m. this weekend, Folk with Matt Watroba airs on 90.5 FM WKAR. And thank you for joining us for this weekend's Current State. Have a great weekend. No, no.